listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats around. We've got a potluck for you today. A potluck is where you send in the question, we answer them. We got all kinds of really good questions today about immutability and CMSs and some updates on using 1Password for environmental variables and all kinds of really good stuff. So excited about that. Today we are sponsored by three awesome companies. First one is FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. Second one is LogRocket JavaScript Session Replay. And third one is Cloudinary Online Image Hosting Transformation Compression Optimization, all that good stuff. We'll talk about them partway through the episode. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing good. Just doing good in the neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Who has that slogan? Is that like Applebee's or something?
Doing good in the... Something like that. Applebee's or...
Yeah, one of those.
Eating good in the neighborhood.
Eating good in the neighborhood. Yeah, I'm doing better than Applebee's, but doing very good. Just hanging out, doing my stuff here. Yeah, nothing to report. Let's get into this potluck here.
Yeah, I'll grab the first question here is from Seneva. Such a cool name. It's pronounced like Geneva, but Seneva, I like that a lot.
It's like Geneva in syntax.
Oh, yeah. I like that even more. Hello, I'm finally getting on board with the GraphQL train and have a specific question about the nomenclature. Having worked with Redux in the past, immutability was a concept ingrained in the head. I continue to see benefits of immutability updates across all sorts of libraries, frameworks, vanilla JS, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe we should pause there real quick and just explain what immutability is. The idea of immutability in JavaScript, and I guess just in programming in general, is that instead of directly reaching into your data and overwriting it with updates, you basically just take a copy of that data and update the pieces. And the idea, sort of the idea behind that is that you're not accidentally updating data that you were thinking about. Like let's say, for example, array.sort method. That is not an immutable method, meaning that if you were to have your array and then you were to call.sort on it, it would sort that original array instead of taking a copy of a new array and then sorting it based on that, because then you still have the old array if you need it and things like that. And that has all kinds of benefits in terms of tooling and whatnot around it. We've talked about it a lot on the show, but I thought I would just do a quick rundown. Anyways, back to the question. I'm learning GraphQL now, and I'm taken aback by the fact that the CUD, create, update, and delete, operations are called mutations. Okay, so we're just saying how immutability is awesome, but then everything in GraphQL, when you want to change, update, delete data, it's called a mutation. Is there a reason why we use the term mutation despite the fact that best practices dictate that we should want to implement immutable updates to objects? Does GraphQL actually mutate the objects behind the scenes? Whew, okay, good question. It's kind of interesting because like you hear a lot of people are just like hammered into them. Everything must be immutable and whatnot. There must be no side effects. That's another one we see a lot as well. But then you get into GraphQL land and everything is a mutation when you want to update it. So at the end of the day, you sometimes do need to be able to update your data. And that is why they call it a mutation, because you're literally taking the data that you have probably in a database and you are changing it from what it exists in the database and what will exist in the database. So it's not that mutations are bad. It's just that in generally in the front-end world in JavaScript, it's more that you should take a copy of it. So the idea of having a mutation in GraphQL world is not necessarily bad, because at the end of the day, you do have to have it. Same thing with side effects as well. I'll throw that in there. Sometimes you do need to actually reach outside of a function and update the title or overwrite some HTML.
Never is kind of a hard word in programming, because you can sometimes go through some pretty big hoops to avoid not doing some things that just because somebody said at one point not to do something some way. So that's always an important thing to remember, is that, you know, absolutes, I don't know if they're great to work in.
Totally.
I always thought that the mutation word of it was just like, if you're changing your data, it's a mutation. If you're getting your data, it's a query. But sometimes I was wondering if that mutation was like you're thinking about you're mutating or changing the cache, the cache in the UI. That's the thing at the end of the day in the UI that's being updated and changed is the cache, the data that you're, in some cases, the normalized cache that you're pulling the data from that the UI system, whether it's Apollo or whatever, is pulling the data from. At the end of the day, it's not really the same thing, or it's not necessarily to the same degree that you would say, like,
yeah,
it's not the type of immutability issue or whatever that's going to cause you any issues or oddness or whatever. The types of reasons why we avoid mutating things like arrays or objects is so that when we access the properties of the object that we know precisely what's going to be in there. And sometimes if you mutate the object, then do something else, you can kind of lose track of what the object is and what the data is inside of that object, because some things that mutate the main object kind of have some weird properties in terms of, you know, you console log it out at one point and you check for the values at one point and it's different than what you might expect. These are a kind of a lot of programming issues that people face early on when they're learning JavaScript, especially if they're using a lot of methods or things that mutate the data. So just in general, I find like that to be a rule when working with the data in those kind of ways and not necessarily something greater.
Yeah, I think the key word that you're trying to describe there is just like consistency in your data so that you know when you call something, when you update a property on something, the output of that will always be
right.
X, Y, or Z, and it has no bearing on things that happened before. It's just what data got passed into that function.
Totally. Okay. So next question is from Mark Began. He says, how do you sleep at night? And I read this and I was like, what? What are you talking about, Mark? And then his second part of his question says, I mean, how do you switch off your brain when you're trying to go to sleep and your brain just wants to keep on coding? Mark, I have a lot of issues around this. I'm not a great sleeper. I've never been a great sleeper. My brain is the type that doesn't shut off. And whether it is like coding problems and, you know, I'm having the brilliant solution at the right time while I'm in bed or the wrong time, I guess you could say, you know, my brain just doesn't shut off. I can definitely spiral into either anxious thought or those types of things and keep me awake. So how do I fall asleep? One thing that I do is I take a supplement called ZMA, which is, it's just zinc, magnesium, and vitamin B. So it's, you know, just those things. And it's just your 100% zinc, you know, just a little bit of magnesium and your daily for vitamin B. And it really helps me stay asleep once I fall asleep and helps me get a little sleepy. I don't recommend everyone taking a supplement to fall asleep, but it is just a kind of a vitamin that you would get if you were taking a multivitamin anyways. So that helps me. But another thing that I do is I don't know how many, if you, this might feel very foreign to us and it may feel very foreign to a lot of people. I grew up with a TV in my bedroom and I would just leave the TV on and then put the TV on a timer, like a 30-minute timer. And then I would fall asleep watching the TV. It sounds very, not great, but from a very young age, that was just like how we did it. You know, that's the way my brother falls asleep too. And so like, it's very funny that like, I cannot fall asleep if I'm not watching a TV. It is really rough, especially because we don't have a TV in our bedroom. That's like one thing that we don't want to have a TV in our bedroom. You know, I just feel like that's too much, right?
Yeah.
What I do is I watch documentaries. I've watched over 200 Kung Fu movies. I've watched a whole bunch of stuff on my phone and I just put in AirPods and I literally fall asleep with AirPods in while I'm watching something every night. That's how I fall asleep. It's called distracting yourself just enough so that you don't let your day-to-day problems overtake your anxious thoughts.
Yeah, this is a good question. I find the wind down just from like other stuff in life. My brain doesn't necessarily like keep on coding. I find that if I am hitting a really difficult problem or I am very excited about something, and usually that happens like, it's like, oh shoot, it's already 5 o'clock. I have to go inside now or go back to the family. What I'll do is I'll try to like write down as much of where my headspace is at that time, put it in a to-do list or write myself a whole bunch of notes. And that allows me to, we say this all the time, out of your head, into your system. And that gives you a bit more of a way to pick it up again instead of it always just rattling around in your brain. And then I also do, I listen to podcasts as I fall asleep as well. I don't really talk about that a whole lot because Anytime I do, you get people being giving you crap for it and whatnot. But
can you imagine what people say about watching a screen, let alone listening to podcasts?
Ever since I was 12 years old, I would fall asleep listening to the radio or literally anything. Nice. And I usually just listen to not coding podcasts, but just other types of podcasts, usually about like heists or murder or things like that, which is super good to fall asleep to.
Sure. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of it. The AirPods have been a game changer for that kind of stuff because it allows you just to lay down and be nice and comfortable. The AirPod Pros are awful for sleeping with, though. So don't use those.
Yeah. One small thing about this, too. I think the wind down from your day is important. Do you know what you said was really, really good about stopping and leaving those comments? Did you know that Hemingway, the author, said that like the best way to stop is to basically stop in the middle of a sentence?
Really?
So that way, when you pick things up, you can feel like you're already moving. And then who else? Somebody, I just Googled this, and apparently Roald Dahl says, "I never come back to a blank page." So it seems like that's like a common author technique, even outside of coding, to like, don't always finish all of your ideas while you're working. Maybe your brain can pick it up. And then maybe that's not a great instance for keeping your code off of your brain. But if you stop at 5 o'clock, which is, you know, I'm so guilty of coding well into the night in my life. So I don't want to judge anybody who's putting in the extra time. But, you know, nowadays with kids and everything, it's so hard to get that sleep and that time to wind down and everything like that. Another little trick I do is I take a shower at night to like really clear my mind and to get me into that headspace and to like get maybe some of my code thoughts out. And if I have any code thoughts out, while I'm in the shower or, you know, when I'm done before bed, I'll just take out what I have as a little scratch pad and I'll just write them down. I use my Remarkable tablet for that, but I'll just scratch some notes down, and I don't want to get too deep in anything, but it'll just be like little notes like investigate this library, you know, that kind of thing.
That's a good tip. I like that. Next question we have here is from John Mars. I thought this was a good question because I know a lot of people are building websites for clients, and it was, how do you manage copy and micro copy on a site? Micro copy, that's a neat word. I'm assuming what that means is just like you've got little sentences here and there. You've got an icon, you want to put some text underneath it. Should you put every piece of text across the entire site into a CMS so that your client can change it, or just the parts you think may be updated in the future, or you just hard code everything directly into the markup or collect it into importable JSON file? If you go the CMS route, how do you wrangle it all into one schema? It seems like way too much boilerplate that end up maybe dozens or even hundreds of different fields. Love the show, guys. You make my morning commute something I look forward to. So this is a good question, because us as developers love to think, okay, you give them a title and you give them an input box for the body and maybe a checkbox is of three different categories, and that's it. And the reality is, especially with a lot of these like marketing landing pages, is that they are one-off designs, and it's maybe too complex that you would put that sort of data into a page builder. Although I think that is starting to become more of a possible option of, instead of thinking about it in terms of like a page that has all these fields, think about it in terms of components that have data attached to them. But I think like there's a couple different levels that you can approach this type of thing. And I almost always lean towards spend the extra time and make everything editable by the client, because you will for sure get, like I've done it many times in the past where I'm like, that little piece of text in the footer. Like I had a client website about a year ago, and I had put like, make sure to like us on Facebook. And they're like, how do I change that to join us on Facebook? I can't find anywhere on the page where I can edit that thing. I'm like, that's probably the one thing I didn't make editable. And it was. And I had to go in and figure out, okay, do I just take their text and update it, or do I make that thing an editable field? So I go on the side of making it totally CMS editable. And that's for me, that's a level 4. Level 1 is just put everything in the HTML. If it's my website, I'll do it all in the HTML, because I'm probably not updating a lot of these different fields. And also it's much quicker for me just to jump into the code a level 2 JSON file. Like you've noted, that's kind of nice because if your client is somewhat technical, you can give them that. Also, if it's like a call to action text and it's used like 6 or 7 spots throughout the website and they want to update the like buy it now to try it now, then you can just put it in a JSON file. That also is really easy if you're doing like translations, like multilingual. That's a pretty popular thing where people will say buy it now button text. Sometimes if you visit a website, and I'm sure our people who don't speak English as their first language see this a lot. Sometimes you visit a website and there is like text on a button or an error and you're like, that seems weird. That seems like a placeholder. And that's because that is a placeholder. And then it should be swapped out with whatever the translation would be for English or French or whatever. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of different levels there. I'm curious what you would do for a client website, Scott.
Yeah, I think I've probably done a little bit of having everything be editable in a CMS. And that was much easier to me, I think, in Drupal than it was for me in WordPress. WordPress, you kind of get into like a situation. Let's say you have a site with like 5 different pages. And those 5 different pages have the content really broken out into very specific sections. It is kind of difficult. You're going to have to create a lot of different custom fields. And that's not a problem. It's just kind of a pain in the butt. I found it to be a little bit easier within Drupal myself, at least to the ability to, for the client to be able to find that content and find how and where it's editable, especially if you set up your admin in a good way. But this is a tough one because it is something that you want to give the client the ability to change everything, but at the same time, you don't want to give the client the ability to mess things up. So clients have a knack for messing things up. And my concern with giving them JSON is that JSON formatting is very finicky.
Yeah, one wrong quote in there and you're done.
One wrong quote, one missing comma, one extra comma, and you break things. So that is a concern I would have there. They would have to be pretty technical for me to give them that. Same with Markdown even. When we're web devs and we're devs or even like younger people who are used to Markdown fields in certain websites to format their text, right? It seems like, hey, everybody knows Markdown. Nobody knows Markdown. If I told, my wife is very technical. if I told her to edit a Markdown file, she'd be like, I don't know what the heck this is. She's great with computers. And she used to work at a computer store. Never heard of Markdown. So there is some concerns there. And I would almost always lean onto just about everything they need to be editable within the CMS directly. Sometimes we've been getting away from CMS-based sites a little bit here. Maybe that is just part of the agreement, is that this is our contract. If you need to change things, you get at me. I have a 24-hour or 48-hour turnaround or whatever your turnaround is, and I will update it for you.
Yeah.
If you don't like that, we can cost out a big thing for me to build you in a CMS. Because not every site needs a CMS, right? Some sites could certainly just be straight up HTML and CSS. I mean, obviously, you'd probably build that in a different way, but I don't know. I would tell you, Wes, I worked with a lot of clients at my agency that we would make their site once. We would spend all this time making everything editable.
Yeah, that's a good point.
3 years later, the client had never changed a single thing and we hadn't touched it. So, yeah.
That's true. It's not outside the realm to just, all right, once every year or two, you just give it a quick once over and we'll edit that type of stuff, because like you're maybe never going to be editing our address, you know, like you're probably not going to be moving your business anytime soon. And if you are, that's not a big deal for me to jump in.
That's often part of our discovery would be like, how often ideally would you update this and how often are you actually likely to update this?
That's true.
And to like have a real conversation with the client.
I even wonder if something like Tina, you remember Tina CMS?
Tina!
It's like a front-end UI. It's not actually a CMS. It's
kind of like Netlify CMS.
Yeah, it's kind of like a edit button for your website where you can edit the actual website in real time. Like you're viewing, you view the website and then you just click edit this div.
Does it make things content editable and then save the values? Is that what it does? I haven't looked into it too much.
If you just like go to tina.io, you can take a look at it and you get your text areas, your images, and you just click on things and you can change the text and update it. And then you have an adapter that will then take that data and put it to your Sanity, your Contentful, or your Strappy, or even Markdown file as well. So that might be a good option as well.
If you didn't know all weird Contentful or Strappy or any, you're just like listing fake words. It's very funny.
If you didn't know what we were talking about, that's what often people reply to my Instagram stories that are like my friends that are not devs. They're like, I don't know what you're doing, but it seems impressive.
I always love that one. Remember that guy who did the YouTube videos? He did the YouTube videos that was like the Excel, e-gaming kind of Excel, Microsoft Excel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What, I forget his name right now, but like he did like that one video where he was talking about Overlord is connected to Bingo because Bingo knows everybody's name-o, which is connected. It's like these could all be real companies. Like I know they're not, but they could all be real companies with all these names.
Macro is his, or Chris Ham is the guy's YouTube.
Yeah, Chris Ham, man. That's a top tier channel right there.
So good. He only releases like one every year. So every time he releases one, I'm like, this is going to be good.
It's brilliant. What's also brilliant is one of our sponsors today, which is FreshBooks. It makes accounting on the cloud easy. Cloud accounting. Imagine that. Everything's on the cloud these days. What's next? Who knows? But for right now, it's FreshBooks. Wes, do you want to talk a little bit about FreshBooks?
FreshBooks is small business accounting that makes billing painless. It's a very tough thing to do as you're trying to run a business, but then you also have to take care of sending invoices and managing your expenses, all that. FreshBooks makes that type of stuff super, super simple. So you can check it out for yourself. Get a 30-day unrestricted free trial. No credit card needed. FreshBooks.com/syntax. Make sure you use syntax in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sick. All right. Next question is from Ben Lammers. Ben says, hey, Scott and Wes, love the podcast and goldmine of expertise you guys provide. Well, thank you, Ben. I am new to using CMSs and was wondering for applications that require a lot of content management where a CMS or a headless CMS such as Contentful is ideal, but also requires a dynamic queries such as recommended content to the end user based on browser history. How do you approach integrating the user data in combination with the data being received and handled from the CMS? A separate API, a database, or is this a scenario where the CMS doesn't fit? Thanks, Ben. Yeah, sometimes you got to ask yourself, are you working against the CMS to the point where the answer is, this is not great for a CMS. You can get CMSs to do just about anything, especially if you're good with the language that the CMS is in. I mean, if you're using Ghost for Node.js, I would imagine you can get Ghost to do just about anything if you're good at Node. And that's really the same thing with WordPress and Drupal. You can do just about anything if you're good at PHP with those software. I personally am not. Many times when we had some really advanced functionality to be implemented into our Drupal site, we would farm it out to a PHP expert. Now, granted, that was many years ago, and I'm sure I could have picked up enough of PHP if I was still working in it. But like I said, if I was using Ghost or something, I feel like I could augment Ghost to my fullest capabilities. And so there is a decision to be made there. And we actually had to make the same decision when we were building our e-commerce store. Do I use Reaction Commerce, which at the time was built on Meteor, and the UI of our site was also built on, or the main version of our site was built on Meteor. So I was thinking Reaction Commerce, it's a store, it's got everything I need. And then I started getting into subscriptions and how that all works within it. And at the time, I didn't know enough Node to augment something. I knew enough to write my own system, but not enough to augment something. So it felt like it was going to be too much work to augment that. And I went in off and I built my own from scratch because, hey, it seemed like the right idea at the time. Now, looking back on it, I probably should have done Reaction Commerce. There's so many little pain points like shipping and stuff that I wish I, you know, didn't have to do. So at the end of the day, if you're having to augment it that much, it is a really difficult decision to make on your part. And unfortunately, not one that has a cookie cutter answer. So like, at what point are you truly working around the CMS to a point where it's a detriment to your time and energy? But then also, you got to look at like, what is that time sink or time cost of writing this all yourself? And it's a difficult conversation, and it depends on how good you are with the language that the CMS is written in, is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I kind of see this as like, it's like your application versus your marketing CMS. Mm. And if your app is doing any significant stuff, I would probably keep them separate, especially because you can kind of keep your app as nice and clean as possible. And then the marketing website, we've talked about this before, is usually a lot more busy. It usually has a lot more third-party stuff added to it. And if you can keep those separate, I honestly think that is ideal. But if it's something simple, like I think back to when I used to do WordPress, I would take contact forms or signups, or if you're taking data from the user and they don't necessarily have an account, then yeah, you can expose APIs. You can make some very simple permissions that allow the public to submit data into your database. I think that's totally fine, but anything larger than that, I would probably reach for something that's not meant for content-based sites and something that's more meant for building a full-blown application where you have authentication and user data.
Yeah, it's a tough call all around. It's not an easy problem to solve.
Next question we have here from Caesar Zepp. When problem solving, do you do it through trial and error, or do you carefully think through every solution and choose the best one before actually implementing it into code? Yeah, that's a good question. Absolutely not. I don't sit there and ponder all the possible options. And then after I've come down from my throne, I place my fingers on the golden keyboard and it all comes out. It's a lot of like churning and reading ideas and failing and hitting dead ends and realizing the thing that you picked doesn't do this one little thing that you wanted. There obviously is a lot of planning into it, but a lot of it is just testing and refactoring and sort of thrashing until you found something that makes a lot of sense for you.
Yeah, it is very difficult to come up with every scenario, solution, idea. Like, it's very difficult to come up with all of that on the spot. Many times when you're implementing something, things become revealed to you in ways that weren't there before. And those are the times where you can maybe evaluate and say, is this the right direction or not the right direction? But just like, it's not necessarily totally trial and error. There's educated guesses,
yeah.
But at the end of the day, they're educated guesses. And sometimes the thing that works in your brain, when you get it out into code, you're like, oh, wait, why was I thinking this would be the right way to do this, or this would be the correct way? And you adjust. You know, a good way around this is something that we've talked about a little bit on this podcast, and I've been doing it more in my courses, where you just write everything out in comments first. You just scaffold whatever idea you have out in comments rather than code. Pseudocode, just comments to say, all right, this does this, and this does this, and this does this. And really quickly, you can kind of see if there's any gaps in there. I write a lot of to-dos too, like not necessarily to-dos as these are tasks, but to-dos as in like, this is something I have to consider. It has to do this. 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 And then I sort them and organize them and sort of do an outline for the code. And that kind of gives you an idea if the code is a good idea or if it's going to be a mess ahead of time before you even write anything. And allows you to validate some of your ideas too. All right, next question is from Mike Laurel. Mike Laurel says, I know Wes is a huge 1Password fan, like myself. Yeah, I am too, actually, Mike. And I would very much like to hear how we can take advantage of the new partnership between 1Password and Secret Hub. Ooh, I've not heard of Secret Hub, but it sounds like a secret GitHub. I feel like getting into .env, but this sounds much more interesting. So, Secret Hub. Wes, have you heard of Secret Hub before? I've never heard of this thing.
I had not, but I threw this question in because, first of all, remember we had the .env show and I said, it'd be amazing if you could just stick your secrets in 1Password and you could use 1Password to like integrate them into environmental variables. And apparently that is possible. They have a whole command line tool that you can use to, I haven't installed it myself. The first thing it tells you to do is to install some sort of CLI for it. What that will do is it will expose your username and passwords as environmental variables. So you can just use 1Password on this command line. And that seems pretty handy. Then I saw this question, which was Secret Hub, which is a product that allows you to store your secrets on a web app and then inject them into your environment of choice, as well as doing some audits and whatnot of that data, which is great because that's how secrets kind of work on all these different app platforms. And then on your app, locally, you usually have a .env file where you put your passwords. And like I was working on some Wise API stuff the other day, And I had to put my Wise username and password into a text file on my computer. And I was like, I don't really like this because like that file gets synced to my backup software, which is in the cloud. So I'm not a big fan of that. So this Secret Hub, it was bought by 1Password. And it looks like they have seen the need for a very simple thing like that. So I'm excited about this because a nice app that is owned by a company that I very much trust to manage and inject your secrets is going to be really, really nice. So I'm excited about this.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll use it, but it looks nice.
It's one of those apps that goes from free to very expensive.
That is like it's such a joke, but it's such a meme joke that it is so accurate. So many of these services will be like, they're free. And then the next tier up is like $200 a month. And you're just like, what? Yeah. Something in between?
That escalated quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Which it makes sense. Those companies are trying to get all of just like devs doing little stuff, side projects, personal stuff. And then they're trying to get their entire team on. I think that's how a lot of these companies do.
Bigger fish.
Totally, totally. So thank you, Mike Laurel, for sending that in. I will be watching Secret Hub for any updates.
Let's take a quick minute to talk about one of our sponsors today, which is LogRocket. Now, LogRocket is the best place to log your rockets. LogRocket is the error and exception handling service that allows you to see the errors make the action that initiated your mistake, because it's always your mistake if you're the developer, right? And so what this allows you to do is see these errors and exceptions happen in a visual video scrubbable replay. It's really cool. It gives you the video scrubbable replay. It gives you the network request, the Chrome dev tools, all of those things that you know and love from your own debugging workflow now are available to you. No more guessing in the dark as to why or when or where or how this thing happened, or even worse, denying that it happened at all. Sometimes clients will be like, hey, your website turned purple. And I say, that's impossible. And then if you had LogRocket, you could go ahead and see you goofed up and they clicked on something and it turned your site purple. And now you got to start apologizing. So what you're going to do is head on over to logrocket.com/syntax, S-Y-N-T-A-X, and you will get 14 days for free. Check it out. This is a tool that you want to see to believe. Okay, let's get into the next one. This is from TJ Space R. Hey, Wes and Scott, love the show. Binged old episodes about a year ago, and I never miss one. Since you have been working a lot in TypeScript recently, maybe you should help me shed some light on this. When creating types in TypeScript, when should somebody use a type over an interface? While I generally understand the differences, it seems like interfaces offer more flexibility. I am struggling to understand why I would ever use a type. Yeah. So it is funny when you first see, like, we talked about this in the TypeScript episode. When you first go to TypeScript's documentation and you see that some people use interfaces and some people use types to do the exact same thing, your first instinct is to say, all right, what's different about these things? Why do they both exist? What's the use case for both of these? And then you come to a table and they mostly do the exact same stuff with a tiny little bit where interfaces can be extended. You have a note here that says types can do a nested alias. What is that exactly?
Yeah, I ran into this the other day. Let me say a super simple example. So you've got a food type, and then you have a sandwich type. And a sandwich extends food, right? Like maybe food has some very basic properties, and then a sandwich has some more specific properties on that are only related to being a sandwich and not a pizza. So you can go ahead and extend that with either a type or an interface. However, if you have properties inside of that type that also need to be extended, so let's say you have an expiry subproperty, and that expiry is its own type. If you wanted to extend that as a subproperty, in an interface, you would have to first extend it and then reference it as a child property in your type. With a regular type, not an interface, it allows you to use the ampersand. So you could say base expiry ampersand open up curly brackets, close curly brackets, and put your extra properties in there. And I was like, oh, okay, that's something since the podcast that we talked about I've never run into before, is that if you want to extend a type as a sub property, you cannot do that with the interface. So that was just like one tiny little use case that I ran into where a type would be better than an interface. And then the other big one I run into a lot is if you want to have an alias, you want to do a quick little one-liner where something equals something plus whatever, something extends something, something infers something, a type uses like any of the utility types that are in there, return type, parameters, all of those have to be via types and they can't be done via interfaces. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of answers for not much, but you'll hit little things.
TJ, I don't know if you need to worry about any of that, because that is in the weeds a bit, and not a fault of yours, Wes. That's just the nature of this conversation. And the nature of this conversation is just pick one, and you can do basically what you're trying to do with either of them, with some small exceptions, but most likely not things that you're going to hit all the time. And by the time that you do hit them, you'll have a bit better understanding of the pros and cons. Like we said in our last TypeScript episode, that I use types to type all of my React components, and I think Wes use interfaces.
Yeah, I use interfaces by default. You use types by default. It's not even a pro and a con. It's just a can't use that one, use the other one, you know, like it wasn't that one, use the other one.
Exactly.
You know, like it's almost silly. I bet it'll all be combined into one at some point for TypeScript 7. Next question we have here from Linus, another TypeScript question. I recently started using TypeScript in React, and typically I'm just using function components. I've been seeing some people say that classes are really great with TypeScript in React, but I haven't found any real use cases benefit myself at all. How about you guys? Do you use classes in React and TypeScript? I don't. Basically, this just comes down to, do you like the class-based approach to writing React, or do you like the function and hooks-based approach to writing React? And I think over the last year or so, people have been migrating more towards the hook-based and function-based way of writing React. And I think like existing code, yeah, absolutely TypeScript, but I think any new code that you're writing going forward, and it would be great with functions. And I don't necessarily see any of the benefits that you would get with a class in TypeScript over a function and a hook.
Yeah, I personally would not write React components with classes again. Personally, I prefer the hooks-based. I don't need the multiple lifecycle methods when I can just use useEffect. I know hooks can be hard to parse for some people, and especially when you're learning them, right? They can be a little bit confusing. But I just cannot imagine whatever benefit somebody is telling you is worth it to be on what would be seen as like sort of the out-of-date style of writing React components going forward. I know that's a bit of a touchy thing, but I personally do not see any benefit there. I'd be interested in hearing the arguments, but I don't think I'd be going back to writing class components whatsoever. All right, next question is from John Elwood. John says, what is /are your opinions on generators like Yeoman? I have never heard you two discuss them as far as I can remember. I didn't even know they were a thing until this morning. So Of course, I started to look at syntax episode and to learn about it and didn't find anything. Just looking for y'all's thoughts on opinions on such animals. Love the show and other nice phrases to get my questions answered. Oh, this is funny. So John's saying that he has to placate us with niceties so that his question will actually be answered on the show. It's like an offering. Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
We talked about them once. If you search Yeoman on the website, we talked about it on episode 41.
Oh, look at you.
300 episodes ago.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Yeoman. So Yeoman is a tool that I remember being very popular in 2011. So John, to give you some context why we're not talking about it a lot, is definitely had its heyday more of in the past. And Yeoman was a scaffolding tool that allowed you to get started. Now, what has replaced Yeoman? Well, a ton of stuff, whether it is create React app to start up a whole React app. Because at the time when you were doing a Yeoman application, the main things to choose from were like oh, I'm going to pick an HTML5 boilerplate, which was just an HTML5 file and some CSS and maybe SAS or whatever, maybe even a gulp file. But nowadays, we're building more things in this context of a front-end framework or an all-encompassing UI framework like React via Create React App, Next.js, or even SvelteKit, Vue, Vuex, or any of these sort of, or not Vuex, Nuxt is the one I was thinking of. Those are all these types of things that really take the place of Yeoman. And so for that reason, I have not touched Yeoman since probably 2012, 2013. Just haven't had the need to, and I might be wrong on those dates, who knows, but I haven't had the need to use it because for the most part, the scaffolding tools that I use already exist within whatever platform I'm writing on. I don't know about you, Wes, but I actually kind of like scaffolding tools. And that was like one of the coolest things about Rails to me. It was like, oh, you need a new data type? Let's just scaffold this all out. It's like CMS light kind of deal.
Yeah.
I've always kind of wanted to build some things like that in my own platform. Like, oh, I'm considering creating a new data type. Well, okay, what do we need? We need a GraphQL type for it. We need the Mongoose connection for it. We need CRUD in the UI. Like, it'd be kind of nice if all that stuff was just baked in to my platform or automatically generated. I have not used Yeoman in a little while. It's a really nice app, fantastic logo, fantastic typography, but that's pretty much as far as I'm going on it today.
I think we have sort of moved away from, not everything, but a lot of things have tucked away complexity where you had so much setup, so much boilerplate that you needed a tool that would give you the boilerplate before you could do anything. And I think we've tucked away a lot of that complexity inside of a framework now. So like in Next.js or Gatsby.
Even package.json is like, wasn't really a thing when Yeoman came out.
Yeah, it's true. There was no way to describe all of that information. So yeah, it's all tucked away. If you look at Next.js or Gatsby, if you want to use TypeScript, you just name it .ts and it's up and running. And even a lot of our build tools have very little or no config at all. So thankfully, it was a tool that was used to solve some of the problems that we had. We either don't necessarily have those problems anymore, or they're built into the CLI tool themselves or an NPX script, where like you don't have to install something to run this. You just run NPX and the name of the script and it will do it. And I'm even wondering now if some of these tools use Yeoman under the hood just to generate out stuff for you.
I don't know if they even need to anymore.
Yeah.
Probably just NPM scripts. Do you see that new thing from Google that's like a easy way of writing Node scripts? It's like a two-letter word or like XE or something. I have to look for it.
Who's it from?
Google. I've been seeing a lot of chatter about it on the Twitterverse recently. People have obviously having opinions on it, whether it's good or not. But it makes writing scripts really easily. I'll find it before the end of this episode, and then I'll share it to you. But yeah, it's basically like it's Google. I was close. ZX. It's basically essentially a way of really easily writing essentially bash scripts inside of just a Node file. And this to me seems like a nice code forward way to write your own kind of scaffolding tools or potentially like script generators, those types of things. And it's neat.
Oh, that's cool.
So I don't know. I'd keep my eye on this. People are going to have opinions about it.
If anyone's trying to understand what this is, the example would be you write JavaScript, await cat package.json grep name, git branch. So basically if you have these bash commands, but you need the data in JavaScript, or you just want to orchestrate it in JavaScript, which I find that to be the hardest part of writing bash scripts. I'm like, how do I loop over these things, you know?
Yes, yeah. How do I prompt the user in the right way with emoji and loaders and
grab every image and rename to PNG. I'm always like, oh, like I know I can do this in a bash script, but I'd much rather be able to just console log and await and use my dev tools and write it in a Node script. So that is pretty nifty.
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody was like, why would you just use this when you could write bash scripts? And I think you nailed it. I know how to do this in Node with Node scripts. And while I could figure it out with bash scripts, that's just a barrier to entry that I don't want to have to spend that time.
Next question from Nicodemus. Hey guys, love the podcast. Learn so much from you. Thank you. I am very passionate about web development, especially front end. I've been looking for a career for a couple of years now, and I've recently landed a job with a small agency getting paid hourly, making WordPress websites. They are a team of SEO specialists and designers using pre-built themes like Avada and Divi. Those are two super big WordPress themes, and I'm using air quotes there because these types of things have, they're essentially a bunch of plugins as well that make authoring your content really good. They brought me on because of my knowledge in web development and want me to eventually run a team of web developers. I'm only the developer on the team, and I'm worried that I'm going to get stuck pushing Divi sites all the time. I know it was a good opportunity for me, but I was hoping you guys can shed some light and give me some tips on how I can put my skills to good use. Okay, so it's funny. We get a lot of CMS questions and a lot of like kind of content-based website questions today. So first of all, congrats. You landed your first gig. And if this is not going to be your favorite gig ever, that's totally fine. You got your foot in the door after what sounds like 2 years. And this is an awesome first website. So I wouldn't be worried too much about getting stuck building that type of stuff. I think it's a really good opportunity that if you find yourself saying, okay, these are things that we do on every website, or I find myself running into this problem on every website, you can start to create tools that will help you. And maybe you can even make your own WordPress framework for building the types of websites that you guys build over and over again. That's pretty common in the agency freelancing space where we build a lot of these kinds of websites. So we need to go ahead and build a plugin. If it turns out to be, yeah, I am building the same website over and over again because these guys are just cranking out SEO websites, then that's totally fine. You can stick with it for 6 months, 2 years, however long you need to in order for it to be a stepping stone to your next job.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's just good experience. And you're going to encounter situations that you're not going to encounter anywhere else. And that's going to come into play the next time you have a situation and you need to make a decision. So like you said, it's everything you do there is going to be a positive for your long-term understanding of both working with clients, projects, any of that stuff in the real world. You know, it's always going to be a good experience. But you know what else is a good experience? Is one of our sponsors today, which is Cloudinary. That was like the all-time laziest ad transition. But you know what, Wes? It's okay because our sponsor really is more exciting than my ad transition. So do you want to talk a little bit about Cloudinary?
I do. So Cloudinary, you know, you can upload your images to them. They can resize them. They can compress them. They can literally anything you want with an image, they can do it. What I want to talk about today is they have add-ons for Cloudinary, which allow you to hook into other services, in some of including their own, and they can run scripts. So they have Cloudinary AI background removal. So part of your uploading of an image, let's say you're using Cloudinary for like a photo editing app, you could automatically clip out the background with AI. Have you ever seen any of these like background removal scripts? They're really good. They also have content analysis. So you could detect if there is a bike or a building or a person or someone smiling in your photos. They have a bunch of these auto taggers, which would be really nice for generating alt text on demand, getting URL to PNG for getting screenshots. So like all kinds of really cool add-ons in Cloudinary as well. Check it out at cloudinary.com. Thank you so much to Cloudinary for sponsoring.
6666666. Next question is from Adam Hopkins. What are your approaches to caching a GraphQL API? Adam, I am not the best at caching. One thing that I like to do, if you're talking about server-side caching of a GraphQL API, I use Mercurius, which is our GraphQL framework for the server side. And it has some baked-in caching for the loaders, or you could tell it to just use Redis. So wherever possible, I personally am leaning on the libraries that I'm using for GraphQL to handle the caching. And I, for the most part, the exception of caching user information or session information in something like Redis on the server side, I personally am staying mostly out of the way from GraphQL caching. And if you're using a library on the front end, I use Apollo. There are many other options, whether that's Urkel, React Query. I want to say Relay as an option, but you know, I'm not using Relay myself. These things have caching solutions baked in. They have like a normalized cache. And that's a huge part of why you would use one of those libraries in the first place. And that way you don't have to manage the caching aspect. So that's what I do. I lean really hard on the libraries that I'm using that I'm already doing the thing.
Yeah, I agree as well. The caching is not something that I think most developers need to be implementing. If it's a client side, Apollo, React Query, all your those libraries will have caches built in, and they will have knobs in terms of how much you should and should not be caching the data. On the server side, there usually will be adapters for things like Redis. You can even just cache the stuff in memory. So very, very simple example I use on my own course platform is that I get the exchange rate for USD to Canadian. And I'm only allowed to hit that API, I don't know, like 20 times an hour. And also it slows down the request a little bit because I'm requesting data from the database, but I also have to go to the API to go get this data. So all I simply do is just store it in memory. And what does that mean? Put a variable at the top of your module, make it a let rate equals whatever. And then also make a let rate updated and then make that a timestamp. And then when you go to get the data, your function that fetches the data will either check if that data is there and is less than an hour old, then it just returns the data in that variable. Otherwise, it goes off to the APIs, fetches it, updates those external variables and returns it. So when people talk about caching it in memory, that's literally all they mean is they're just storing it in a variable, and that variable will eventually be cleaned up when the thing shuts down. Same with serverless functions. I use a serverless function to generate the OG images for my website. And when I was doing it, I was like, all right, where should I store these images? But I want them to only live for like an hour or two, because if I change the text or anything changes about it, then I want to regenerate it. So all I ended up doing is I just Base64 encoded the image, stuck it in a variable, and that serverless function will hold on to that for up to 4 hours, I think. And there's no guarantee, but if it's not cached, then it just generates it again. And that was a really good option because I didn't even have to reach out. I could have reached out to like Cloudinary or something like that, stuck it in there. But in my case, I just stuck it in memory and it was a good enough caching solution for me.
I say that's for small projects, that's almost always the way. We use Redis on our end, but you know, honestly, you can get by with just caching in memory for many, many, many things. All right. Next question is from Neez from Kerala, India. And it says, you guys are doing a great job. And being a subscriber to your podcast, I can rest assured that I will have the latest information in the world of JS. Man, so many great, wonderful messages today. You did mention in an earlier potluck that Svelte is probably the easiest framework to learn. My question is this: how confident can one be to start a new project with Svelte? Being a technical lead, can I propose our team to work in Svelte? Is there enough material solution on the web, and is the community established? I think, in my opinion, yes, absolutely yes. I mean, the New York Times uses it. So that is a pretty big organization to be running Svelte in production, right? A lot of companies run Svelte. It's a big community. There's inherent risks with anything. If you want to take the least risky front-end framework, it's going to be React. But what is the least risky framework, you know, 10 years ago? I don't know. Who knows? Probably jQuery, right? Backbone. Maybe if you were saying full front-end framework, the least risky one probably would have been Backbone. But how many sites are like actively being marketed as like Backbone engineers today, right? So
yeah,
it's a tough call to say, like to buy in into anything. But there are very real stakeholders using Svelte in big projects across the globe. And you know what? I don't think you'll regret it. I personally, if I was starting a project today, it would be in Svelte. As much as I love React, honestly, the only reason I'm still using React on Level Up Tutorials is because there is no way I'm changing that. There's no way I can change it. I like Svelte that much more. So I don't know. It's a calculated risk no matter what you're going to do. And if you have zero risk tolerance, and that risk tolerance is I need to pick the most stable, absolutely thing that is never, ever going to go out of fashion, you're probably in the wrong industry. If you're looking at picking something that has the most amount of developers working in it actively, you're probably going to want to pick React. If you're looking at something that is exciting to you and that you'll be productive in, I have absolutely no issues saying to pick Svelte, and you'll be happy with that decision for as long as you'll need to be happy with that decision for.
I agree. Nothing else to add there. I think you said it super well. Let's move on to the next section, which is sick picks. This is the part where we pick things that are sick. And I'm going to re-sick pick something that I just did again. Maybe about 6-8 months ago, I sick picked these deli containers for keeping all of my spices in.
I saw you Instagramming about that.
Oh, man. So if you didn't hear that one, basically what I did is I took all of my spices that I had in my spice drawer. I bought these little deli containers, which are those like clear plastic container that has a lid on it. And I labeled them all with the spice names and I stuck them all and they stack really nicely. It's really easy to find what you want. And I've been so happy with it. Like, I feel like I'm even a better cook because I have such quick organized access to all of my different spices. We did it at our cottage as well. I changed everything over from random packages of random spices and old jars and things that have dried out because the lid didn't close all the way and things like that. And I totally redid it. And I was like, man, I love these little deli containers for just for spices and just for everything in general. So it's such a simple little thing, but I'm so happy that I found a nice system for it. So I'll link up the ones that I have, but you can even just save the ones that you get from takeout. So we did for about half of them.
Totally. Yeah. Sick. I'm going to sick pick a blender bottle. If you are the type who's, you know, working out, you got protein shaker bottles, you got protein powder, you shake them up.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever used the official blender bottle, which is the one we've always used, this is a cheap plastic crap with a, you know, metal little spring in it that shakes it all up. And those things are just junk. They're always spilling. The seal isn't great. It's cheap plastic. I kind of feel bad drinking anything out of cheap plastic, you know, like, especially, I don't know, for some reason I get weird about liquids, you know, whether it's hot liquids, cold.
Not
know.
Spices though, Scott, right?
Not spices. No.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
No. I see what you're saying. What, did you buy like a mason jar blender bottle?
Well, that's the whole thing. You don't want to put them in the dishwasher and stuff. You know, these things get nasty. You got to get them clean.
Have you ever left one in your gym bag for 6 months and opened it?
6 months, I think I would just nasty. Even leaving it in the sink for one day is nasty.
Awful.
So I got these Contigo. You probably heard of Contigo.
Love Contigo.
Yeah. So they make thermal lock stainless steel blender bottles, and they're reasonable. It's $12. And the thing has like a screw on top lid for the thing, so it won't spill.
Ooh.
The blender part is actually thing, and the whole thing is stainless steel. So, you know, I treated myself to a $12 Contigo blender bottle because I was just like, actually,
this is nice.
This is actually a fairly ridiculous story that Courtney and I had the exact same parallel thought. Our child, we don't know which one, hid the only blender bottle we had left in the house. And Courtney and I both been like, we cannot find the blender bottle. Where did it go? And then Courtney's like, is it wrong that I considered just buying a new one because we can't find this? I was like, no, that's exactly what I was doing. Not only did I do it, but I ended up actually buying these ones because I was like, you know what? One, we can't find it. But even if we did find it, it's a crappy experience. $12.
Yeah.
I'm going to splurge on the $12 stainless steel blender bottle for something that you use every day if you're hitting the gym. So.
Oh, yeah. It's super easy to clean stainless steel as well.
Yeah, which is, you know, the biggest thing with gross ass blender bottles. So yeah.
My Yeti is stainless steel, and every now and then I just fill it full of vinegar and let it sit for a couple days.
Oh, maybe.
Throw it in the dishwasher after that, and it's like brand new. Man, this is great.
Well, you could pickle some onions in there while you're
That's actually not a bad idea. Oh, that's great. Contigo makes such good stuff. I went on a tangent a couple of years ago to find the best kids cups, and Contigo ended up having them. And there's just this one specific Contigo cup. Maybe I'll sick pick it at one time. That is so good for kids.
Sick. Shameless plugs. At the time of listening to this course, maybe for those of you who are interested in diving into the world of Svelte, you can check out the latest course on leveluptutorials.com. At the time of release of this is Svelte Kit. I don't have an, that's the working title. It's going to have a better title than just straight up Svelte Kit, but it's on Svelte Kit. And we're going to be showing you how you can even convert a Sapper site into Svelte Kit, which is painless. But we're going to be talking all about the what's, where's, why's, how's, when's of Svelte and Svelte Kit. Why the heck you would pick a Svelte Kit over anything else. We'll get you up and running to the point where you can feel confident doing anything that you would need to do in a building a basic site with Svelte Kit and feeling very comfortable about it. Svelte Kit, in my mind, is the future. And if I wanted to start a new project, this is the tech I would pick. I'm going to say that straight up. Also, if you are interested in becoming an author for Level Up Tutorials, we do have a new author form where you can sign up. We pay both an upfront cost to your work. That's a non-advance. Many times with these companies, they try to pay you in advance and then take your royalties out of that advance. We're not doing that. So, you know, you could get an upfront payment as well as royalties for your series. If you wanted to do a tutorial series for Level Up Tutorials, I will make sure I have the link in the show notes. Also, I'd love to tell you about the Level Up Tutorials spring sale that's going on right now. We're doing 50% off of annual subscriptions. Every single tutorial series on the site is on sale. So head on over to leveluptutorials.com/pro. And if you are not currently a pro subscriber, hit that subscribe button and you're going to be getting a lifetime of 50% off until you unsubscribe. So check it out, leveluptutorials.com/pro. We have a new tutorial course every single month, tons and tons of stuff. So you'll get access to the entire back catalog, as well as 12 new additional courses over the course of the next year, as well as a ton of additional features and tools. So check it out, leveluptutorials.com/pro.
I will shamelessly plug all of my JavaScript courses. If you want to learn JavaScript, you want to brush up on JavaScript, you want to learn a couple new frameworks, Next.js, Gatsby, you want to get really good at fundamentals in JavaScript, go to WesBoss, WESBOS.com/courses. And you can use the coupon code Syntax for $10 off. There's also a whole bunch of free ones in there as well. And that is all. Anything else to add there, Scott, or should we wrap this sucker up?
Let's wrap it up.
All right. Thanks so much for tuning in. Catch you on Monday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.